The last time Christian Pyatt was on the show, we were talking about the risks of lumping persons who self-identify as spiritual but not religious under the broad label of nuns. He's also been on State of Belief talking about his book, Banned Questions About Jesus. Always audacious and always deeply thoughtful, Christian has published a new challenge to readers in the form of a book titled Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? With the assumption that that title refers to the faith and not to the author, I'm happy to welcome Christian Pyatt back to State of Belief Radio. Christian, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me back on, Weldon.
I just can't get away from the first lines in the book. You said that people were going to be upset about this book, and you're probably right. I've read it. It's a terrific book, and I can see why some would be upset. You kind of wanted them to be upset, didn't you?
Well, in a manner of speaking, yes. I feel like people should be provoked or at least a little disturbed by the book, which is one reason when Tony Campolo came out with his endorsement that said it's an important book but very disturbing, I thought that was a great endorsement.
Yeah.
Because what I'm doing is challenging a lot of precepts and assumptions about Christianity that I think people have kind of held at the core of Christian identity that I believe is not necessarily what should be at our focus. So, you know, that's going to be feel a little bit uncomfortable for some people.
Right. Well, I want to start by asking you to answer your own questions that are in the book's title, What is Left? Can We Fix It? And Do We Care?
Right. Well, I think the good news is that the things that are left are the essential core tenets of Christianity, which are faith, hope, and love. And the fact is that those things don't necessarily need Christianity as an institution to survive as it is today in order for them to still endure and manifest themselves in the world. So in some ways, by having a lot of the institutional and traditional systems challenged or even crumbling in some ways around us, it actually gives us permission to let go of those things that aren't life-giving and that actually we've been putting a lot of resources, good money after bad, into sometimes, rather than really focusing on living out those things that Jesus calls us to. There are some things that we don't need to fix. I talk about welcoming the refiner's fire, so to speak, that some of these things that are being burned away need to go away. We need to welcome that because it actually is freeing us up to do more gospel-centered work in the world. And I think as far as do we care, although fewer and fewer people do care about the institution of religion, it's a very consistent concern of people's and preoccupation and of people in the world and in the United States in particular to pursue a more deep understanding of God, understanding who this character of Jesus is, and understanding what it is that gives us real meaning to our lives.
You know, I appreciate in the book the recognition you give to people whom I suppose many folks would say are non-religious. I was thinking about when you were on the show before talking about the nuns. Would this book appeal to the nuns?
I think it absolutely is aimed at those who may be de-churched or unchurched or suspicious or even damaged or hurt by institutional religion, or just maybe have grown up in that culture where we don't really feel like we owe the institution the same things that preceding generations before us who assumed that there was inherent goodness in institution. And so I think for them, to give them permission to seek God, to live out the gospel, and to have an even intentional community and practices of worship and study and discipleship that aren't necessarily confined by the traditions found in Christian institutional religion, I think is very permission-giving and liberating for some who might identify as spiritual but not religious, for lack of a better term.
And my sense was in asking that question to myself, I saw it just as you do, very positively, because I think that people who have been hurt by religion and people who are in that category of the nuns are going to be far less defensive in reading the book and more open to what you're saying.
Yeah, and I think that that's really commonly where I end up being, where I am offering kind of comfort and reassurance and hopefully an open invitation to those who have felt on the outside of religion and a challenge to those within it.
Yeah, good way to say it. In Post-Christian, you present the seven scandals of Christianity. Would you say something about those, please?
Sure. They're roughly based on the seven deadly sins, but they're sort of paraphrased, if you will. So you've got the Christian scandal of greed. You have the scandal of judgment, fear, and so on. The one that I think surprises most people is the Christian scandal of certainty. And I spend quite a bit of time talking about that in the book, that I believe we've become addicted to certainty about our beliefs in Christianity, and that's become a very dangerous thing.
Yeah. You also offer the seven virtues of Christianity. What do you say about those?
Right. For every Christian scandal that I present, I try to offer a Christ-like virtue. So I'm inviting people to be less Christian in the sense that, like Gandhi once said, you know, I like your Christ. I don't like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ. Well, then let's try to pursue not being more Christian, and let's just focus more on being Christ-like. And what would that look like? So I balance those scandals with a Christ-like virtue. So we have humility, we have generosity, love, courage, and sometimes they may not look exactly the way you think. For example, when I talk about love, it's not this sort of warm, fuzzy, feel-good kind of thing. It's the thing that lays you bare and makes you most vulnerable to the most powerful force in the entire known universe, I believe, which is love. It's not just something meant for good. If love is directed in the wrong way, it is a deadly weapon. And so it is availing ourselves to the power of love and whatever way it will have with us. And similarly, when I talk about the Christ-like virtue of courage, some people think of that as sort of the doubling down in the culture wars, a more militaristic or aggressive kind of courage. But I'm actually calling people more in the Brené Brown sense, the courage to be vulnerable and laying ourselves bare to those who might seek to do us harm. And I think that that is the only way that we really earn the right to be heard and to be understood as those who are trying to pursue this vision of what it means to be more like Jesus in the world.
This is a debate we hear frequently in our culture. Some say religion is essential to keep humanity civilized. Others blame religion for the worst atrocities in history. So, on balance, looking back over the past 2,000 years, which side wins in your mind?
Well, actually, in my book, I say that both sides, I think, are out of line. But at the same time, both sides have some element of truth to them. I think if we focus exclusively on the ills that have been exacted on the world in the name of religion, we actually miss the point, because that's kind of like focusing on guns, you know, rather than just the people and the way that they're using guns. You know, the institution of religion itself is an inherently amoral system. It depends on how we use it. It only has the amount of power that we afford it. And so I think what we really need to do is we need to reorient our priorities, because I say that we've actually come to worship the false god of religion. We have actually venerated it above God and the gospel itself. And in that way, we have given it undue power over our lives and the world. And so in that way, we need to put it back in its proper place, where it is serving a means to an end rather than being the means to its own end, which I think is evidenced by the fact that, you know, we can look, for example, you see that the Catholic Church in North America alone has a budget of approximately $40 billion. And yet the United Nations food aid organizations, you know, suggests that it would take only about $7 to $9 billion a year to eradicate hunger from the face of the earth altogether. So we, you know, the critics are right to level some, you know, some judgment of hypocrisy toward us, because we obviously don't fully, you know, have our priorities in order. And so there's some reorienting that needs to take place. But I think just to inherently say carte blanche, we need to throw religion out altogether, I think is to be a little bit reactive.
Christian, I was impressed by the way you use the terminology post-Christian era. I think it's important for people to understand, especially when hearing about the book for the first time, that's not a phrase that you use wringing your hands in despair. It's actually, as I see it, an opportunity to remake Christianity in the image of Jesus. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, because what we're really talking about here is post-Christendom, or the end of Christian hegemony in the Western world, the end of Christian dominance. And I know that for some, it feels that that is our sort of divine right, the sort of manifest destiny made real. But the fact is that I believe Jesus' followers wanted him to do something similar and basically, you know, enter into Jerusalem as a triumphal victor and to basically take over rule and establish a new kingdom here on earth in that way. But the fact is, as Walter Wink says, if all we do is change the rulers and not the rules, then nothing really changes. And Jesus, I think, saw that we needed to subvert those systems of rule and dominance entirely, rather than just changing the figureheads. And so in that way, there is a revamping of Christianity that needs to be done. And I think being in a position of less dominance in the culture is actually a good thing for us, because it gives us a healthier perspective on where Jesus wanted us to come from in the first place.
We've alluded to this already, but I want to pick up and look at it more closely. There's a tension in Christianity today between conservative and progressive forces. We just saw it play out at the Catholic Synod of Bishops in Rome. Young evangelicals are challenging their churches on social issues. Where does this tension fall in relation to the idea of a post-Christian era? Because both sides clearly value their vision for Christianity very intensely.
Yeah, and I think the problem comes not so much in which positions we take, but when we value our ideology over the fellow humanity of our brothers and sisters, or whether when we elevate certitude, the importance of being certain and right about what we believe over having community with someone who may be different than us, I think that's where the real violence and the real problems and real divisions come from. And, you know, it reminds me of when my wife and I started a church in Southern Colorado about 10 years ago, and we had somebody come and they said, well, you know, I don't really believe the same things you believe. Is your goal here to make me think and believe more like you? And I said, no, what my hope is that we will cultivate a love among us that is greater than our differences. So I don't necessarily think we all need to see things the same. I think it's actually good that we have pluralistic views within the greater body of Christ. But the thing is, we need some stronger connective tissue founded in love and mutual trust that actually allows us to have those differences and still stay together at the table. I think that's really what we've been missing in the ideological warfare that's been kind of putting us at each other's throats for far too long.
Christian, when someone picks up this book and reads it, what is your hope that they will think or feel by the time they reach the end of it?
Well, I hope that if they are coming from the position of sort of feeling like they need to sustain or protect organized religion, that they'll feel a little bit of permission to not focus quite so fiercely on preservation of that. I think if they have felt on the margins, which is a big demographic that I speak to a lot, people on the fringes of Christianity, nominally Christian, spiritual, but not religious, that they'll feel that the table has been expanded just a little bit and that there is indeed a place for them in that space, and that they will enter, regardless of where they're coming from, that they'll enter into some serious personal inventory, if you will, both individually and collectively as groups, about what it really means to follow Jesus, what the differences are between belief and faith, where these sort of where certainty festers and manifests itself in our daily lives, and where it wreaks havoc in our relationships and our pursuit of a more holistic embodied faith. So those are the kinds of things that I hope people will. I hope they'll feel challenged, but also in some sense reassured that the things that Jesus were trying to remind us were important are fortunately not dependent on us to sustain in the world, that they will be here long after Christianity is dead and gone, if that happens to be the case. So I think there's more at stake than just religion itself here. And I hope that's reassuring for people and not just scary.
Christian Piatt is the skillful author of the thoughtful new book, Post-Christian, What's Left? Can We Fix It? Do We Care? Among his other books are those in the Banned Questions book series, including Banned Questions About the Bible and Banned Questions About Jesus. I hope you pick up this book and read it. It's going to surprise you. You'll laugh some. You'll scratch your head some. You'll have to think some. And you may even be more attracted to the truth of this book than you anticipated when you started reading it. Christian, I always enjoy hearing your original take on some of the most important questions facing religion today. It's a valuable book, and I appreciate you being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I always appreciate the opportunity.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. With Thanksgiving coming up on Thursday and a long weekend is going to knock a lot of people out of their regular routine. So I want to ask you to be sure to tune in for State of Belief Radio, because we'll have an all-new episode for you this time around. Next week, we'll look at how today's battles over religious liberty in this country compare with the freedom the Pilgrims were actually after when they landed at Plymouth Rock, with Dr. Peter Gardella, author of American Civil Religion, What Americans Hold Sacred. We'll also be discussing the way Native American spirituality informs this season, both historically and today, with Dennis Zotai of the National Museum of the American Indian. Plus, a very special conversation I've waited for a long time. The Reverend Frank Schaefer, who risked his ministry in the United Methodist Church over celebrating the same-gender marriage of his own son. We'll hear his story of church trials, abiding love, and integrity next week on State of Belief. You can make sure you won't miss a word by subscribing to our podcast at stateofbelief.com. I encourage you to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. These social platforms are a great way to share stories that you find to be important with friends and family. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And please keep State of Belief in mind the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, increasingly known as Giving Tuesday. This year, Giving Tuesday is December 2nd. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Please join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.